Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. For 25 years, my guest today has seen firsthand how schools, police, and the juvenile justice system criminalize what a lot of people used to think of as normal adolescent behavior and rebelliousness in communities of color. Kristen Henning was a lead attorney for Washington, D.C.'s juvenile unit in the Public Defender's Office, then later a professor of law at Georgetown University Law, where she directed the Juvenile Justice Clinic. Through her work, she has seen the disparities in treatment, pretrial dispositions, access to diversion programs, and adjudication between accused white youthful defendants and Black and Latinx adolescents. Adolescence traditionally has usually been considered a time for youths to test boundaries, to make mistakes, hopefully learn from them, and learn about who they are and what they want to be. We used to grant a little leeway on that. Now, increasingly, we've criminalized much of that behavior, especially in communities of color. And Professor Henning, through social science research and through the record of juvenile justice, details those disparities and how generations of discriminating and aggressive policing have socialized Black teenagers to fear, resent, and resist police, and how society in turn views Black youths as a threat to white America. Her book is titled The Rage of Innocence: How America Criminalizes Black Youth. It's published by Pantheon. She's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Professor Henning, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Rich.
In your book, The Rage of Innocence, you open with a story that at first glance, or if you heard it as a small item on a nightly newscast, it would probably cause you to pause. But the way you tell the story gives us a whole different meaning of what that event was. And it involves a student that you represented that you call Eric. And Eric saw something about a Molotov cocktail, and he decided to make one. And he put it in his backpack, forgot about it, brought it to school, and it was made out of things that wouldn't combust. It was just an experiment of sorts. He hands it to the school guard, and he's immediately treated like he is about to create a mass killing event at the school. Tell us about Eric and how this spurred the book, Rage of Innocence.
Yeah, Eric's story is really an epitome of how differently Black children are perceived than white children. Eric was really engaging in what was typical adolescent creativity. He was 13 years old. And as you indicate, he was just watching a movie and thought he wanted to make something that looked like a Molotov cocktail, and he did not research it at all. He just went into the kitchen and started pouring together liquids, and he used a piece of toilet paper as his wick. And we as adults know that this never would have caught on fire. He really didn't think anything of it. He put it in his book bag and went to school on Monday, 2 days later. He made that little item on a Saturday night. He completely forgot about it, put it through the conveyor belt in his book bag on Monday morning, and a school resource officer saw it and said, "What is this?" To which he immediately said, "Oh, that's nothing. You can throw it away." And he went on to class. And next thing you know, police officers showed up, the fire department showed up, and they just simply would not believe him when he said that it was just a toy. And that led to a 9-month ordeal in D.C. Superior Court. We represented him. We had expert witnesses trying to demonstrate that this wasn't flammable, that there's no way it could have been flammable, that he had no intent whatsoever. And here's what's the kicker about the story was several months later, I went to a conference and I was speaking at that conference and I told Eric's story. And a white woman came up to me after the conference and said, "You know, my son did the exact same thing." And when I asked her what happened to him, she said that he was placed in advanced accelerated science classes, really to just feed that creativity. And so that's just a clear statement of just how we perceive children differently. You know, schools that Eric went to were heavily policed, whereas the young, and they would not only were they heavily policed, but they just wouldn't give Eric the benefit of the doubt. The presumption was that he was a danger and he was a threat. With the white child, the presumption was that he was smart, creative, and had potential. And these encounters that young black children have are really traumatic. I mean, Eric was yanked out of his classroom, arrested in front of his classmates, marched down the hall. He was ultimately suspended from school and from all of his extracurricular activities. And so the consequences also are really profound for black children.
You know, a lot of times we hear how what used to be considered adolescent pranks are now criminalized. Mm-hmm. It seems like that happens with a great disparity. And what you write about in The Rage of Innocence is this happens in great disparity in communities of color as opposed to white communities. Do we have any good evidence on how policing has changed towards adolescent behavior that, you know, at one point might have been considered pranks? It could have been just, you know, knuckleheaded behavior that a police would say, don't do that and go on home. And now it's criminalized.
Yes. I mean, we definitely have seen a shift, and it's an increase in fear. And I will say it's not just in law enforcement that, you know, wears a blue uniform, but in all of us, whenever, you know, we as civilians see children on the street, in class, at, you know, the park, or, you know, anywhere we might encounter them, we tend to be afraid. And that shift has come over time in history. There was a temporary uptick, for example, in the 80s and the 90s in crime. And in very intentional ways, black children were painted as the primary perpetrators of that crime. And there was a pseudoscientific prediction that black children would run amok and take over society. This was known as the super predator myth. And that led to, in the 90s, very significant changes in the juvenile and criminal law, making it much easier to try and to view black children as dangerous, as threatening, and as adults. And so even when that myth, that super predator myth, proved not to be true, it was pretty clear by the time we hit 2000 that the myth just wasn't going to pan out and that black children weren't going to be this terror and threat, we still never undid those laws. So that's one piece of it. The other piece is that there has been considerable research showing the ways that our racial bias have a unique impact on perceptions of black youth in particular. So there's this really wonderful study by Dr. Philip Atiba-Goff and some of his colleagues demonstrating the ways in which civilians and police officers perceive black youth to actually be older than they actually are, and older by 4.5 or more years. So when you think about a Tamir Rice who was shot at the age of 12, the police officers kept saying he looked to be older. So they perceived him to be, you know, 16 or 17 years old. You know, think about many of the young people at the ages of 16 or 17 playing pranks, as you said, perceived to be adults. There is other implicit bias research showing that black adults and youth are perceived to be stronger, heavier, taller, more threatening than they actually are. There's evidence showing that individuals are more likely to perceive innocuous or ambiguous facial expressions and behaviors on black children and adults as more threatening and aggressive and violent than they actually are. So there's a lot at play that explains this shift and this complete, really, what has now become an intolerance of black adolescents. The things that many of us were able to do as children, as teenagers, is now perceived as criminal. Everything from the music that they listen to, the friends that they hang out with, the clothes that they wear, you know, throwing snowballs at each other, tussling in a park, all of that is now perceived to be dangerous and threatening when it is a Black child engaged in that conduct.
Yeah, you have a little section on school dress codes and how it, you know, the hoodie, African-American hairstyles. I mean, a lot of things are targeted that are not targeted in that way in other communities.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, dress code is a really important one because the hoodie has really become this iconic figment in American imagination of a Black threat. I mean, we've seen it with Trayvon Martin getting shot. We just, you know, period, you hear story after story and you see images on television that are painted as if the hoodie worn on a Black person is a threat. And what's so powerful about it is if we...
It's a code of some type, as I think it's how it's perceived, which is really amazing. Because, you know, a white kid wearing a hoodie doesn't have that code in place.
Absolutely. Think about all of the football players, the American high school football players who show up in a hoodie, or young white girls going to yoga class, right? Or any of us going out for a quick run to the grocery store. You know, when a white child wears such a garment, it's not perceived to be dangerous at all. And another one is sagging pants. You know, sagging pants have actually been criminalized on the books in many cities across the country. And, you know, hey, we can maybe even agree that we don't want to see a child's underwear, but the approach, the response to make it a criminal offense is what's problematic. And we think back throughout history, all of the different fashion styles, like the all Black goth attire that was worn by, you know, traditionally by white youth. And some of whom, not all, but some of whom engaged in some very violent, you know, mass shootings. We never criminalized the clothing itself. Or think about the hippie era and the tie-dye shirt. We never criminalized the tie-dye shirt, although it was commonly known that, you know, the hippies were, you know, using drugs, smoking marijuana. So,
well, now we're getting into other stereotypes.
Right, exactly.
My guest today is Kristen Henning. She is a professor of law and director of the Juvenile Justice Clinic at Georgetown University Law, and previously was a lead attorney of the juvenile unit in Washington, D.C.'s Public Defender Service. Her book is titled The Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth. It's published by Pantheon. Well, before we leave this subject, I mean, there is one serious topic that has changed and it certainly has grown over the last 20, 30 years, and that's school shootings. And so you have a system that is far more vigilant for that particular behavior, but it sounds like it's crept through the whole range of adolescents, rebellion, expression, rambunctiousness. From that, perhaps one noble cause of trying to prevent school shootings.
Absolutely. And there are, you know, a few important pieces. One thing that we should remember is that school resource officers were increased significantly in schools after the mass shooting in Columbine in 1999. But what the data shows is that the school resource officers are far more likely to be sent to urban schools with a high percentage of Black and Latinx youth, which is curious when you recognize or recall that most of the high-profile shootings, and especially Columbine and Sandy Hook, took place in white middle-class or even white wealthy suburban neighborhoods. And so the response really ultimately didn't match the reality of what happened in those places. Moreover, just as you said, Rich, when the school resource officers began to really proliferate urban Black and brown schools, they indeed began to intervene in normal adolescent school discipline, talking back in class, not paying attention in class, checking a cell phone in class, you know, being, you know, disorderly or disrespectful in class, all of those things that used to be handled by teachers and counselors. And certainly there is a feel among teachers and principals that I understand that they want to be able to focus on teaching and not have to worry about behavior. But we cannot possibly turn to police officers and send children to jail and detention facilities for normal adolescent behaviors. And there is alternatives. There are fair and appropriate alternatives to improve school safety and to manage classroom behavior that don't involve law enforcement. So we've become far, far, far afield of the response to school shootings in the 90s.
You talk about police in schools, and in fact, community policing officers or police officers has trebled in the last 20 years or so, from about 9,400 in 1997 to over 27,000 in 2016. Can you talk about some of the roles that those policing officers are doing in schools that really they're not qualified for?
Right. Such a good point. So, you know, there's a movement afoot called the Police Free Schools Movement, and people sort of bristle at that, and because it sounds more radical than it actually is. But your question framed it beautifully. It is a call for all of us to think more critically and more creatively about what it is precisely that we need police officers to do and what it is that police officers are best equipped and trained to do, and then not ask police officers to do those things that they shouldn't be involved in. And one of those things is, for example, routine school discipline, routine behavior management in school. Another thing that police officers shouldn't be involved in is working with children who have special education needs or who have mental health needs. And so now what we see police officers doing is managing the screening children as they enter the front door to school every day with metal detectors and the like. But even beyond that, we've got teachers who understandably want to manage their classroom and so psychologically default to what they've been told. You now have a school resource officer you can call. So call them instead of a counselor or a mental health provider or a behavior intervention specialist or social emotional control or learning teachers and the like. So police officers are honestly just doing too much. There have been a solid increase in the reports of police officers using physical force against students, whether that be, again, a student having a temper tantrum because they've got attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. The school resource officer is called in and is not trained to work with a young person like that. And so they do what they've always been trained to do as police officers,
which is
and they use physical force.
Yeah, they put them down on the deck and put handcuffs on them, usually.
No, I
understand. You know, a big part of the book looks at how disparity and how similar offenses are treated among juvenile offenders or, you know, just juveniles, whether it's really an offending behavior or not. And also the traumatization of Black youths from that disparity. Can you talk a little bit about that as far as the whole idea of how Black youths are treated by police once they're in the system?
Yeah. So I hear, you know, sort of two questions in that. One is, you know, what does that trauma look like when Black youth are in frequent contact with the police, and particularly for normal adolescent behaviors that white youth would not, you know, be in contact with police. And so I'll start there, which is there has been a growing body of psychological research demonstrating the extraordinary trauma that Black and Latinx youth experience in heavily surveilled and heavily policed neighborhoods. The research shows that Black children who are the target of frequent stops or frisks or, you know, questions, where are you going, where are you coming from, experience high rates of fear, anxiety, depression, even hopelessness. They live with this pervasive sense that they're always being watched, and they develop tremendous distrust for police officers. They become hyper vigilant, meaning that they're always on guard or worried about whether they're going to become a victim of some, you know, of some police encounter. And remember, even when a police officer means well, even when a police officer approaches a Black child for a wellness check, that Black child is contending with everything that they've seen on television, all of the high-profile encounters that they have seen, and they live in neighborhoods where they see their friends and their family members being disproportionately targeted. So that has an impact on how they view police, and so we should take that into consideration. The other thing I hear in your question is, so once a child has been arrested and then referred over to juvenile court, are they still treated differently? And the answer is unequivocally yes. You know, in America, we made the decision that we would recognize that children make mistakes and that children can be rehabilitated. Children are resilient. And so we decided to set up a system of separate juvenile courts so that we wouldn't incarcerate children with adults, and that we would use rehabilitative mental health alternatives to incarceration. And what we're seeing is that Black children aren't given that benefit. They aren't given that grace. They aren't given that forgiveness. They aren't perceived to be as amenable to rehabilitation. And that's just not an accurate portrayal of Black children at all. We all make mistakes. And so we all should get a second chance. But Black children are far more likely to be detained pending trial in a secure detention facility. They're more likely to be found guilty even on the same factual evidence. They're more likely to be incarcerated on the back end once they are found guilty than white children. And it's just a sad statement about our unwillingness to show grace and support for Black children in our country.
Throughout the book, you often will tell a story of a Black person who is put through the system, a young youthful offender, or brought up on charges. And then you immediately contrast that with a very, very similar case involving white defendants. And you see incredible disparities. How common is that in the system?
Oh, it is extremely, extremely common. And even at the most severe levels, if you think back to some of the high profile crimes that are really unfortunate, you know, committed by white youth, and how we respond so incredibly differently. I mean, think about how Dylann Roof, you know, who, you know, shot up a church, killed people, and was treated differently, was entitled to, you know, be brought in alive, first of all, without, you know, being killed himself. There's the iconic picture of the police officers driving through a fast food restaurant there. You know, he's entitled to come to court and have due process. There are multiple examples, you know, that we can think of in terms of like sexual assault, contrasting Marcus Dixon from years ago, who was, you know, treated as a rapist, an adult rapist, for having sex with a white girl in Georgia, as opposed to, you know, Brock from Stanford, right?
This was a swimmer.
You know, treated. Yeah.
This was a swimmer from Stanford who was found passed out on top of two girls. Was charged with sexual assault and yet was found guilty, and yet the judge basically gave him a slap on the wrist.
Right, right. And so, you know, I use that methodology, you know, in parts of the book in my effort first to identify those adolescent behaviors that are not as violent as the ones we just talked about, and to urge the reader to find themselves or to see themselves and their own childhood in those stories, or to see the adolescent mischief of their own children in those stories, whether you're white or you're Black, and then you can recognize the contrast. And then I do the same thing with these much more serious offenses, like, you know, rape or murder, and show that even at that level, we still have disparate treatment of Black youth and white youth. And so it's really, you know, important for us to understand these stories and the impact of those stories and those lived realities on Black children.
On our last couple of minutes, you offer some prescriptions on how to change the system. What are some of the first changes you'd like to see in our juvenile justice system?
I think about solutions in broad buckets of categories. And I think one broad category is that we have to radically reduce the footprint of policing in the lives of all children, and particularly Black and Latinx children. And so that happens in a number of ways, one of which is in the school system that we've already talked about, thinking about where do we need police most and to do what tasks and what responsibilities, and then take them out. And so we can, you know, regulate that. We can invest in alternative strategies for public safety. That's one approach. The other thing is we need significant regulations so that when police need, it's necessary for police to come in contact with young people, that they are trained and equipped to do so. So that requires a comprehensive set of training requirements, regulations, memoranda of understanding, accountability. All of that has to take place. And so training would include training on adolescent development, understanding the key features of normal adolescence. It includes training around implicit racial bias. It includes training on de-escalation strategies, so learning how to calm a teenager down. We know that children are impulsive, emotional, and reactive, and adults learn strategies to work with young people. So those are sort of two big buckets, and I think on the back end, in terms of the once children get arrested and referred to court, we have got to make available the same rehabilitative responses for young people, for children, for Black children in the juvenile courts as we do for white children. So that includes diverting Black children out of court and into community-based services. That includes, even when we're dealing with young people who have committed very serious crimes, that we use the evidence-based rehabilitative programming that is out there that we would use for white kids. Black kids should get those same opportunities.
Professor Henning, appreciate your time today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kristen Henning is a professor of law and director of the Juvenile Justice Clinic at Georgetown University Law School, and was a lead attorney for the juvenile unit in Washington, D.C.'s Public Defender's Service. She is the author of The Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth. It's published by Pantheon. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.